From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The community is outraged. They demand more charges for all the officers involved and enhance the charges that the officers that was acquitted to add more charges like party of a crime, attempted murder, obstruction of justice, and other things. And we're going to demand a federal investigation outside the state.
Three white police officers charged with brutally beating an African-American man have been acquitted by an all-white jury. We'll go to Milwaukee to speak with the victim's aunt and his attorney about the stunning verdict. Then, a look at Darfur.
In Darfur, Sudan, people are being killed, displaced, burned, bombed. Children have been killed. Pregnant women have been raped. Women of all ages, children down to 8 years old, have been targeted.
We'll speak with Fatma Haroun, a Darfurian refugee, and Juan Mendez, the United Nations Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, then legendary Nigerian writer Wole Soyinka, the first African to win the Nobel Prize. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Israel, the death toll from Monday's suicide bombing in Tel Aviv has reached 9, making it the deadliest Palestinian attack on Israel in almost 2 years. Dozens were also injured in the blast, which occurred on the second-to-last day of Passover. The Palestinian militant group Islamic Jihad claimed responsibility for the attack, and Hamas, which now leads the Palestinian government, said the attack was justified. This is Hamas spokesperson Sami Abu Zuhri.
We assure our Palestinian peoples the right to defend themselves, and this operation is surely a natural reaction to the continued Zionist crimes carried out against our Palestinian people. Therefore, the occupation is responsible for these developments and escalation. We have continuously said that the occupation is what will be responsible for all the results stemming from their aggression and escalation, and therefore the problem is the attackers and the Palestinian people are defending themselves, and they have the right to do so using all the means available.
The bombing was widely criticized by the international community. Israel accused the Hamas-run Palestinian government of being part of a new axis of terror along with Iran and Syria. This is Dan Gillerman, Israeli representative at the United Nations.
We will not passively allow human bombs, Katyushas or Qassams, to penetrate our territory, kill Israeli citizens, and put our people at risk. Let me make it very clear. Israel regrets any loss of life, but any attempt to equate the loss of life caused erroneously by Israel acting in self-defense with a suicide bomber specifically targeting women and children is morally wrong and false. Terror is terror is terror, and can never and must never be justified.
Islamic Jihad said the bombing was carried out by a young man named Sami Hamad from Jenin. The Independent of London reported Hamad was only 17 years old, but other news accounts said he was 21. In a video recorded before the blast, Hamad said the attack was dedicated to the thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Monday marked what is known as Palestinian Prisoners' Day. The suicide bombing came just days after the Bush administration barred U.S. citizens, U.S. companies, and foreign companies operating in the United States from doing most business with the Hamas-led Palestinian Authority. Last week, Oxfam International warned the humanitarian crisis in the West Bank and Gaza will only worsen as the international community cuts off aid and contacts with the Palestinian Authority. According to Oxfam, over 60% of Palestinians live on about $2 a day. Here in this country, in Durham, North Carolina, two members of the Duke University lacrosse team have been arrested and charged with first-degree rape, first-degree forcible rape, and kidnapping. Last month, a black female student from North Carolina Central University accused three white members of Duke's lacrosse team of rape. The woman was hired as a dancer for a lacrosse team party held in a house rented from Duke University. There, she says she was beaten, raped, and choked by three white lacrosse members who also called her racial epithets. The lacrosse players, Reed Seligman and Colin Finnerty, are both 20-year-old sophomores. They were arrested early this morning. Bond has been set for $400,000. In India, survivors of the Bhopal chemical plant disaster have succeeded in finally forcing the Indian government to take steps to clean up the site of the 1984 gas leak that killed thousands. On Monday, India's prime minister vowed to clean up the pesticide factory as well as to provide fresh drinking water for local residents and to build a memorial for the thousands who died in the disaster. For the past 20 years, survivors have been attempting to get help from the Indian government and the U.S. company Dow Chemical. Earlier this year, a group of 40 survivors and activists walked 500 miles from Bhopal to New Delhi. Last week, they began a hunger strike. In Nepal, pro-democracy protests are continuing for a 13th day. On Monday, police shot dead one protester. The BBC is reporting police in Nepal have arrested 25 government officials for demonstrating against the king inside the Home Ministry. Among the detained are four high-ranking officials. This marks the first time civil servants have been arrested for joining opposition protests against the king. The Supreme Court has rejected an appeal from two Chinese Muslims who are being held at the U.S. military prison Guantanamo Bay, even though the government acknowledges they were mistakenly detained. The men have been held for more than 4 years. Lawyers for the men said they should be immediately released, but the Bush administration has refused the request. Officials say they've been unable to find a country that will accept the men after their release. Both men are Uyghurs and do not want to return to China out of fear they'll be imprisoned and tortured. In political news, former Alaskan Senator Mike Gravel has become the first Democrat to officially announce he'll seek the party's nomination for president in 2008. Gravel served in the Senate from 1969 to 1981. He was an outspoken critic of the Vietnam War, vowed to remove U.S. troops from Iraq. He said, quote, President Bush's mistake is not worth the life or maiming of one more American soldier. And San Francisco is marking the 100th anniversary of the great quake of 1906 that killed between 3,000 and 6,000 people. The earthquake left at least 225,000 people homeless and destroyed 25,000 buildings. It was one of the worst natural disasters in the country's history. Meanwhile, Russia is preparing to mark the 20th anniversary of the nuclear disaster at Chernobyl. A new report by Greenpeace claims the health effects of the world's worst nuclear accident have been grossly underestimated. The International Atomic Energy Agency has maintained radioactive fallout from Chernobyl caused 4,000 extra cancer deaths. But Greenpeace puts the actual number of extra cancer deaths at 93,000. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go to our top story of the day. Communities in Milwaukee are continuing to voice outrage over an all-white jury's decision to acquit three white police officers charged with brutally beating an African-American man. Local religious leaders and activists are planning protests against the stunning verdict, including a march this morning and a fast later this week. U.S. attorneys are now considering filing federal charges against the officers, and Milwaukee's chief of police has launched an internal investigation. The victim is Frank Jude. He was nearly killed in October of 2004 when he was beaten at a party by a group of off-duty police officers, all of whom were white. According to news accounts, they accused Jude of stealing the wallet and badge of one of the officers. As many as 15 officers surrounded Jude and viciously beat him. Jude was repeatedly punched and kicked in the head and body. His fingers were pulled back, a knife was put to his neck and anus, his pants were cut off, and objects were jammed into both ears. An emergency room doctor who treated Jude testified he had the worst ear injury she had seen in 15 years of practice. The doctor also testified that Jude had two fractures to his sinus and nasal bone, an eye swollen shut, a grossly swollen hand, marks on his neck consistent with choking, and cuts and bruises over much of his face and body. It took 4 months for criminal charges to be filed. District Attorney Michael McCann blasted a, quote, police code of silence that he said hampered the case. The three officers charged, Andrew Spengler, Daniel Mazarek, and John Bartlett, were acquitted by an all-white jury last week. After the trial, one of the jurors, Vaso Sasich, told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel he thought Jude may have suffered his injuries by fighting the officers and getting thrown to the ground. Sasich went on to say, quote, "Our job was not to make perfect a very imperfect investigation. We did our best. We can hold our heads high." Meanwhile, the Milwaukee Sentinel is reporting two of the acquitted officers have a history of complaints against them. John Bartlett has been accused of using excessive force against black men on three other occasions, including a fatal shooting. Daniel Mazarek used a taser stun gun on six people in an 11-week period last year. At a rally across from the county courthouse on Monday morning, religious and community leaders blasted the not guilty verdicts. Father John Sesachowski told the crowd, quote, "Did Jim Crow die in the 60s or did he move to Milwaukee?" We go now to Milwaukee to speak with two guests. Jonathan Safran is Frank Jude's civil attorney. He attended the trial and has been closely following the case. We are also joined by Frank Jude's aunt, Doris Jude Porter. She's been organizing rallies to bring attention to Frank's case with the group Justice for Jude, Justice for All. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! I'd like to begin with Frank Jude's aunt, Doris Jude Porter. Tell us what happened back in October of 2004, as you understand it.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. 2004, my nephew, Frank Jude Jr., was beating near death. And from October to January, it was silence. Hello? The case was silenced until Frank Jude's attorney, Safran, released the photo in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And that's how the community found out the severity, and even also the families found out the severity of Frank Jude's injuries and the beating and who was total responsible. The code of silence and the contaminating the scenes and no one coming forward also hampered the criminal investigation. We had to rally for months on end in order to get any participation with the chief of police, or because D.A. McCain said originally at first he was not going to charge any of the officers until the rallies. So therefore, and now I'm so disappointed, even the outcome, it was overwhelming of evidence. Even the jurors, they took the interpretation Frank fighting, like they said, they didn't listen to the witnesses. The jurors, the witness, one of the ones who observed, and they said was so credible, and Tony said they pulled Frank out of the truck. Frank was not fighting back. They beat him severely. They counted, and still they chose to ignore the true evidence and interpret it with the way they want. That's just like Milwaukee. All these justified beatings and homicide, the system have been interpreting the way they want, and it always come out justified, and we want to put an end to this.
Jonathan Safran, I want to ask you the same question. Going back 2 years, you also sat there, as did Doris Jude Porter, through the trial. But if you can explain, Frank Jude went to the party with a group of people, and this was a party of a lot of police officers?
Correct. He was with another gentleman who was a friend of his. He was with two other women that were also invited to this party. And he arrived at the party, felt after he came inside, after only being there for a few minutes, as to how the reaction was of those in the home, that he might not be welcome. He felt uneasy. Again, the gentleman he was with, Mr. Harris, is black. Mr. Jude is biracial. The two women that were with them coming to the party were white, and they immediately felt, in their words, bad vibes, and they left within a very few minutes and left the home.
And the police officer there accused Frank Jude of stealing something?
Right. After they left, they were immediately surrounded by a group of up to 15 of the off-duty officers who were yelling, "Where's the badge? Where's the badge?" Supposedly, Mr. Spangler, whose home it was, who was hosting the party, claimed that his badge had been stolen. He claimed that he'd left his badge out on a night table in his bedroom, even though there were that was the room that everyone would come into in putting their coats on. He claimed he left the badge on his night table. Drinking had been going on since approximately 7 or 7:30 the night before. This was, again, about 2:45 in the morning the following day. And he claimed that his badge, which had been left in open view, had been stolen. And these individuals with Mr. Jude were accused of stealing this badge.
And so they took him out of the car?
Right. They demanded that they get out of the car. They identified themselves as police officers, continuously yelling at them, "Where is the badge?" Mr. Jude and Mr. Harris were literally pulled out of the vehicle by a number of these off-duty officers. They were immediately confronted, and things went down from there. Mr. Jude was eventually taken to the ground, and the beating began.
Charges were not brought against these officers until this picture of Frank Jude brutalized in a hospital bed appeared in the Milwaukee Sentinel?
What happened was we had continuously been working with the district attorney's office as far as providing them with our cooperation, trying to gather evidence ourselves, independent from what the district attorney's office was doing. But we began to realize that things were not moving very fast. This was, again, now 2 or 3 months after this incident occurred. And although we were repeatedly being told that charges were in the process of being issued, it wasn't happening. And we made a decision that the best way at that point to try to move things along was to get this out into the public's eye. We then came to the Journal Sentinel, which is our local newspaper, had one of the reporters there do a very large article that appeared on a Sunday morning. And that just started the uproar in the community and eventually led, within a relatively short period of time after that, to charges being issued against three of these officers.
The Milwaukee District Attorney, Michael McCann, explaining the amount of time it took, 4 months, to bring criminal charges, said he blasted a, quote, police code of silence. How did it actually break? Did police officers come forward?
Well, there were two on-duty police officers that were eventually called to the scene, and those two officers gave testimony early on in this case and provided statements implicating at least these three officers that were eventually charged, among others. And so the district attorney's office relied upon the testimony by these two on-duty officers to eventually bring the criminal charges against those three officers that were charged.
Mm-hmm. They were drinking.
There was a lot of drinking. There were a good amount of testimony indicating that a number of these officers were significantly impaired. And it is interesting that the rules that apply to the Milwaukee Police Department and their officers says that officers either on duty or off duty cannot be under the influence of intoxication, cannot be under the influence at all. There were clearly evidence of significant amounts of drinking. There were three kegs of beer. There was significant amounts of other alcohol there, but no testing was done of these officers to determine their levels of intoxication, even though other officers testified that some were significantly impaired.
Now, this latest report of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the records of these police officer, who were just acquitted, two of them, can you talk about their backgrounds?
Well, one of them, as has been reported, was involved in a significant number of complaints relating to the use of taser guns, stun guns in Milwaukee. The other officer, Jarn Bartlett, was involved in a police shooting that led to the death of a gentleman by the name of Mr. Jenkins. And he is a defendant in a civil 1983 case that is pending in federal court in Milwaukee. It is actually going to go to trial beginning, I believe, next week. So he has certainly been involved in some other incidents and, according to the records, was involved in a criminal conviction a number of years ago when he was involved with apparently being charged with fleeing from the police.
Jonathan Safran is Frank Jude's civil attorney. There were also reports the crime scene was poorly handled, that there was possible tampering with evidence. Can you explain?
Well, sure. There was, amazingly, the first responding on-duty supervisor was a sergeant who had literally been a sergeant for only 2 or 3 months. This was a chaotic scene, as described by everyone. and it was not handled in the way that any of us would believe would be a normal crime scene. The area where Mr. Jude was being beaten, although there was blood on the ground, was never taped off. There were these on-duty, whether off-duty officers that were running throughout the streets, in and out of homes, in and out of bushes. And the four, what were considered to be the four main suspects at the time, three of whom were charged, were allowed to remain in Mr. Spangler's home without any officers being in there to watch them or separate them, which gave them obviously an opportunity to potentially compare their stories. Their clothes were never analyzed as far as blood, or their shoes and were never analyzed as far as blood. Some photographs were taken of their hands many hours later, but one of the officers who was charged, his hands and his clothes were never analyzed, never photographed at all. Some of the officers left. Some of the officers came back. There's evidence that some of the officers changed their clothes by the time they came back. There just was no possible way that this investigation was handled the right way, and that led to, obviously, very great difficulties by the district attorney's office in having what we would consider to be normal, sufficient evidence to pursue their case.
So what can happen now in terms of this case being pursued?
Well, there were five accounts and five verdicts that were provided as part of this criminal case as far as state charges. The jury was hung on one of the charges relating to Mr. Bartlett. The district attorney's office has already indicated that they plan to retry Mr. Bartlett on that charge. There are some other charges pending against one of the other officers as far as a perjury charge relating to this investigation. And I spoke to the U.S. attorney's office Saturday morning after this verdict came in late Friday night, and I have assurances from the U.S. attorney that they will devote the resources necessary to investigate this, to pursue the claim, to get it in front of a grand jury, hopefully have indictments issued, and to prosecute. And I believe that if they do that, there will be many more officers involved. Hopefully all the officers who are present may very well be involved in this investigation, which will hopefully lead to other additional criminal charges and further prosecution and hopefully convictions.
Jonathan Safran is Frank Jude's civil attorney. Doris Jude Porter, what was the response of Frank Jude himself to the verdict, the acquittal of the three police officers?
Well, the response of Frank, he was unhappy that they got off, and hopefully he told everyone to be calm, but also take action and making sure that these officers doesn't beat anyone else again. He wants them off the streets.
Given the racial mix of the community, how is it that it was an all-white jury?
It was up to the Bartlicks and Spanglers and Missouri's attorney and the district attorney who select the jurors.
You're headed off to another protest today. What are you demanding, and what kind of organizing is going on in your community?
Well, justice for Jude, justice for all, campaign against violence, police accountability, urban underground, Citizen Action, MICA, and other organizations are coming together to protest change into the community. We do not want a watered-down version to distract us in the moment, the heat of the moment. We want to make sure that we definitely get changes in the judicial system here, making sure that these officers, when they have misconduct, they do not get paid when they are fired or suspended. We also want this code of silence to be ousted out of the police force, because if they are truly protectors and peace officers, what purpose do they need a code of conduct? When you need a code of conduct when you're going to hide something, and they've been hiding things too long for the last 30 years that I can recall. Every officer that committed crimes have all came back not guilty and homicide justified.
What is the relationship between the community and the police of Milwaukee?
Distrust. Even when they, even written records, written statements, verbal statements, complaints, We feel that they falsify information. Even past records now, we have doubt that we feel strongly that they false witness, false testify, and gave false reports. Well, we are very distrusting of the police officer. And some of the children, I know my children kind of look at them like monsters or boogeymans.
I wanted to ask...
And they have absolute power can do...
I wanted to ask you very quickly about another case. I'm looking at the Chicago Tribune reporting that after nearly a month of questions, the families of two Milwaukee boys missing since they left home to play basketball several weeks ago received tragic answers Saturday. Their children accidentally drowned in a lagoon about a mile from their homes. Their bodies were found, Purvis Virginia Parker, 11, and Dre Henning, 12, recovered Friday night in a park lagoon. Autopsy results Saturday confirmed their identities. This was right before one of the protests. Their bodies were found after the verdict. Can you talk about that case as well and what it has meant for the community?
Yes, justice for Jill, justice for all was in front of the safety building before the verdict even arrived, asking for a calm and nonviolence because we wanted to pursue this case in a calm manner, because we do not want to give the city any more money through jails or through hiring attorneys or burying our children or getting them, you know, medical attention. So that's why we ask for peace and calm. And when the verdict and when I found out about the missing boys, it's the exact same time when I found out the verdict was in. And to me, it overwhelmed me because the distraction from one end, it was a distraction. And the community felt that it was a distraction. And it appealed to be, and some people think it's conspiracy to, some people think the police officer was involved in this missing boys case. It was just, and the community just really confused about the whole issue because of the verdict and the missing boys was found, came in at the same time.
Well,
it's mind-blowing.
Doris Jude Porter, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We'll continue to follow the story. I head to Milwaukee. We'll be there on Thursday. Doris Jude Porter is Frank Jude's aunt. She has been organizing rallies to bring attention to Frank's case with the group Justice for Jude, Justice for All. We've also been speaking with Jonathan Safran, Frank Jude's civil attorney, who attended the trial throughout. Again, the three white police officers charged in his brutal beating have been acquitted by an all-white jury. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
عبه رضاً ليته عتب علّ بيننا واشياً كذب أو مفنداً يخلق الريب ما لا واحتجب ودع الغضب ليت هاجري يشرح السبب كلما مشى أخجل القطب بين عينيه والمها نسب ما أخده
Music by the Sudanese singer Abdel Gadir Salim. here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to what the UN is calling one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world, Sudan's western region of Darfur. The African Union has set a deadline for the end of this month for warring parties in Darfur to agree on a new ceasefire. Since 2003, two rebel groups, the Justice and Equality Movement and the Sudanese Liberation Movement, have waged an armed struggle against the Sudanese government. The rebels are fighting to end what has been described as genocide against the mainly black inhabitants of Darfur. The Sudanese government has responded by backing militias known as Janjaweed. At least 180,000 people have died in the region. Over 2 million people have been left homeless. Earlier this month, the Sudanese government blocked the top humanitarian official at the United Nations from visiting Darfur. The official, Yang Eglin, accused Sudan of trying to cover up for ethnic cleansing. He said the situation is, quote, changing dramatically for the worse. Hopes for an African Union-brokered ceasefire remain grim. The current talks mark the seventh round of negotiations between Khartoum and the rebel groups in the last 2 years. Previous ceasefires have repeatedly been broken. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council remains divided on how to address the issue. At the UN Monday, Russia and China blocked a measure backed by the U.S. and Britain to sanction four individuals from both sides of the conflict over alleged abuses. Russian and Chinese officials said they wanted to await the results of the ongoing peace talks. The U.S. Ambassador John Bolton said the U.S. would force a vote on the issue anyway.
We have felt for some time that the sanctions procedure was an important aspect of our policy, American policy, toward Sudan and Darfur in particular, and an important element of the Council's policy as well. So this will be, in effect, the test of the Council to see if this sanctions procedure is going to work at all. And we have moved slowly, unfortunately slowly, but we've certainly come to the point where it's time for a decision.
Here in this country, a growing movement is mobilizing to put pressure on the Sudanese government and the companies they do business with. Last week, the California State Teachers Retirement System Board voted to divest from any companies with ties to the Sudan. The board oversees the country's second largest pension fund. The vote came just weeks after the University of California Regents approved a similar measure. Both decisions followed concerted campaigns from California student activists. To talk on the latest developments and the response in this country and around the world, we're joined by Juan Mendez, the United Nations Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide. He's visited Darfur twice since his appointment in July 2004. We're also joined by Fatima Haroun. She represents the Darfur Rehabilitation Project at the Sudan Peace Advocates Network, a refugee from Darfur who's lectured widely on the ongoing crisis. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! I'd like to start at the UN. Juan Mendez, you attempted to speak about what's happened in Darfur before the UN Security Council, but you were blocked by who?
Well, that was when I had just returned from my second trip to Darfur in early October of this year. And there was an attempt to reach consensus, and the Chinese and the Algerian delegate at that time were first to object to it. And at the time when a final decision had to be arrived at, the U.S. delegation, which until that time had been speaking in favor of my briefing the council, suddenly turned around and opposed it as well. And then the Russian delegate also opposed it. This could have been a procedural issue. It could have been voted on. But the chair at that time, the Romanian ambassador, evidently wanted to have consensus. So I didn't brief the council at that time. But the U.S. delegation later visited me and gave me an explanation that I think means that in the future I won't be blocked, at least not by the U.S.
So what's this issue of the four individuals to be sanctioned? And do you think this is adequate?
This is an important issue. The sanctions regime has been approved in general by the Security Council more than a year ago. But as happens in other countries as well, it's one thing to say there will be sanctions, and then, especially if they're targeted, individual sanctions, then applying them to individuals takes forever, apparently. I think it's important that we start applying the sanctions regime so it's not just an idle threat. It's a real specific way of separating individuals who are an obstacle to getting the solutions in Darfur. I am not familiar with the four names that the U.S. and U.K. delegations have circulated, so I can't comment on whether it's appropriate or not. It seems to me like four is a very low number.
Is Ghosh one of them?
I don't know. Mm-hmm.
who had just been to Britain and who had been brought to the United States and has an intelligence relationship with the United States.
I have no idea. But what I do think is that the number probably should need to be a lot higher than four, although the delegations proposing it have said that this is only the first step. But as a first step, it also is already encountering some difficulties in the council.
What happened to Jan Egeland, the top humanitarian official at the United Nations who went to Darfur?
The government of Sudan did not allow him to go to Sudan, to enter Sudan, and they also did not allow him to go to Chad via the airspace of Sudan. So, in effect, they barred him from visiting the area where most of the humanitarian action in the world is taking place today.
Fatima Haroun, what is happening in Sudan?
I can call it genocide. It is crimes against civilian innocent people, killing, burning, looting all their resources and displacing them, burning them is devastating. That's what's going on a daily basis. Civilians who are disarmed, have nothing to defend themselves, are being attacked by the Janjaweed militia backed up by the government troops, and they are being bombed from the air by helicopters. And this is going on, is being denied by the government of Sudan, but there are a lot of evidence and documents to prove it.
Who is perpetrating this?
The government and the militia Janjaweed that are supporting the government.
Who are the Janjaweed?
They are Arab groups from Darfur who have interest, and the government has promised them if they kill the African indigenous people, they will get the land, they will get all the privileges, they will be predominant in the area, and that's what they're doing. And they were given chances to steal and take away everything.
What are your estimates of how many people have been killed?
It's very difficult to make an estimate, but I can say up to 700,000 people have been killed, either by direct killing or by disease and malnutrition. And
what do you think has to be done right now?
I will ask for an immediate intervention of the international community, I mean the UN.
What happened, Juan Mendez, to the African Union?
Well, the African Union has done a wonderful job, both in protecting people on the ground and in sponsoring the Abuja talks. But in both cases, it has been half measures, in the sense that the international community did not give the African Union the full support that it needed. It has been chronically short of funds. It has been at least $200 million underfunded. And so their presence on the ground has been limited. Where they've been present, they've been doing a very good job, but they have not been
underfunded. It?
Well, the international community, the big nations, Europe and the United States.
And why won't they fund the African Union?
Well, they did fund it up to a certain extent, but they not only did not fund it at any time at the level that they needed, but they also announced that there won't be renewals of that, and that's what made the military observer mission begin to set dates for its termination. And now we're talking about a replacement or at least an integration from that force into a larger UN-sponsored force.
When?
That's the problem. I mean, we at least for 6 months or so, there's now an extension of the mandate of the AU. Because we need at least a six-month lead time to prepare another force to be there, maybe even more than 6 months.
There's an extension of the mandate of the African Union, and yet it's not funded.
That's right, but there's going to be a donors conference soon, at which point I am hoping that it will be funded, and not only funded to just to keep it as a bridge force, because a six-month will be a very dangerous period, especially the people who are vulnerable now are going to be even more vulnerable in the next 6 months. So I'm hoping that the funding will come at a level in which this force is not just kept there, but strengthened.
In whose interest is this to continue? I mean, how is it possible with the UN saying this is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, that year after year this continues, that you as a UN official can try to speak before the UN Security Council, and four major forces, China, Russia, the United States, Algeria, stop you from speaking?
Right. Well, I think the question of my briefing the Council is important for me and for my office, but it's not important in the large scheme of things. As long as
just as an example,
as long as my reports are before the Council, and they are, the Secretary General passes them on to the Security Council, and I think that what I have to propose is considered by the Security Council. But I think the main problem that we have had so far is that we have been dependent on the cooperation and the consent of the Sudanese government. For good reason. I mean, of course, if you can get this done with consent, it's always better than to do a non-consensual intervention. But the facts on the ground and seeking African solutions to African problems is, in principle, a good idea. The problem is in Sudan is that we have been completely dependent on the consent of this Sudanese government that has been playing games with that consent all along. The AU has not been more effective on the ground, not only because of lack of support by the international community, but also because the Sudanese government has at every step hampered its ability
to protect people. Well, the Sudanese government are the perpetrators. Why would they say fine? Why would they in any way consent unless forced?
Well, because it's in their interest, to avoid international isolation, or to avoid more international isolation than they suffer now. But unfortunately, they are able to recruit allies, partly in some African Union members, but mostly in the Arab League, and so they, and of course some other major powers that seem to protect them, and so they are able to forestall more robust action by the international community. The problem is that we're getting to a point where things are very, very dangerous, and unless we get more serious about telling the Sudanese government that its cooperation is essential, but with or without its cooperation, the people in Darfur are going to be protected, it's not clear to me that we can avoid a major disaster.
Do you have any hope, Fatima Haroun?
Yes. It seems that American people are getting to know a lot about the issue in Darfur, and they're putting pressure on the American government. And I am hoping that something better will happen. And by the end of this month, there's a big rally in Washington, D.C. to show the U.S. that is very essential to take an action and stop the genocide in Sudan.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We've been speaking with Fatima Haroun, who is a refugee from Darfur, now living in Philadelphia, lecturing widely. She works with the Darfur Rehabilitation Project and Sudan Peace Advocates Network. And Juan Mendez, who is the United Nations Special Advisor to the Secretary General on the Prevention of Genocide. They will both be speaking along with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for his columns at the New York Times, and with UN Deputy Secretary General Mark Malik Brown, an event called We Are the Best Hope for the Peace in Darfur, Wednesday here in New York at the New York Society for Ethical Culture off Central Park. I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We come back, we will be joined by the legendary writer, by the Nobel Literature Prize winner, Wole Soyinka. We'll talk about Sudan. We'll talk about Nigeria. We'll talk about his life. Stay with us.
Kai galun kolobu kai welo kupenanjo.
Music by the Nigerian musician Celestine Ukwu here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 420 stations around the country, on Pacifica NPR, Low Power FM College and Community Radio stations, on Public Access TV and PBS TV stations, as well as both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. And our headlines are also there in Spanish, as we are joined now in our Firehouse studio by the legendary Nigerian writer and political activist Wole Soyinka, first African ever to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, considered by many to be Africa's most distinguished playwright. While fighting for African democracy and justice, Soyinka has been repeatedly exiled from his homeland as well as sentenced to death. At the age of 33, he was thrown in prison without trial for appealing for a ceasefire during Nigeria's civil war. He spent 2 years in solitary confinement. Upon his release, Wole Soyinka became a courageous voice for human rights, democracy, and freedom, has been an outspoken critic of many Nigerian administrations and of political tyrannies worldwide. Much of his writing has been concerned with, quote, the oppressive boot and the irrelevance of the color of the foot that wears it. Wole Soyinka has written a new book. It's called You Must Set Forth at Dawn, a memoir, and he joins us here today. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
I wanted to start by asking you about Sudan, since we were just talking about this. What is your assessment of what's happening and why the genocide there continues?
First of all, I think it's generally acknowledged that a heinous crime is going on in the Sudan, even as we're talking now. And it's a blot on the conscience of the world, and particularly on the African continent, especially so soon after the Rwanda, whose memory still haunts us on that continent and should haunt the entire world as well. Now, why is it continuing? I listened to part of the program just now, and an expression which was used happens to be very apt. The Sudanese government has been playing games with the world, with the African Union in particular, has been playing for time in order to conclude its mission of ethnic cleansing in the Sudan. It's been acting very unscrupulously and using this its surrogate, Janjaweed, to execute one of the most atrocious crimes we've witnessed since the beginning of this century, which is still very young, of course. And the lack of resources of the African Union. Again, I was very impressed by that statement that, you know, treating an issue like this as a family affair with a family solution is all very well if you have the resources to back up that principled position. If you haven't, then it becomes a global concern. And it's about time, I think, that the international community accepted its full responsibilities in the Sudan.
So what do you think has to happen right now?
Well, first of all, there's another dimension, there's another zone of responsibility, which nobody has said much about. Now, these crimes which are being committed, there's a direct, stated, quite overt and, you know, boastful purpose to it. The Janjaweed, when they kill, when they murder, burn, and rape, they say clearly that they want to Arabize that Darfur, that part of Africa. In other words, they're acting on behalf of some very distorted notion of Arabism. Therefore, those on behalf of whom these crimes are being committed, I mean, in their name, so to speak, the Arab world, the Arab League in particular, also has a primary responsibility to call their erring member to order. Sudan, after all, wears two identities. It's a member of the African Union. It's a member of the Arab League. And it's not enough to leave this task to the African Union. The Arab League has a clear responsibility. And I think that if a family member of the Arab world, you know, if a family member errs, then the entire family has a responsibility to say, you cannot do this in our name. And if you do this, we expel you, we cut you off, we denounce you, and we proscribe you from our community. I expect that kind of action of deep and profound moral integrity from the Arab world.
We're talking to Willa Soyinka, the great writer, the Pulitzer Prize winner, won the prize for literature. He has written a memoir called You Must Set Forth at Dawn. You write about your life, and before we talk about that, I want to ask you about Nigeria today. In the last months, we're seeing oil companies post the largest profits in the history of the world. Of any company, of, for example, ExxonMobil, hundreds of millions of dollars given in the retirement of Lee Raymond, the former CEO. We're talking ExxonMobil, we're talking Chevron, we're talking the variety of companies, ones you know well because they do a lot of work in the Niger Delta of your country, Nigeria. Can you talk about both what happens there and the level of protests that we have seen in the Niger Delta?
Well, some of these companies and the governments that they represent, you know, in some cases, make a mistake when they think that the indigenous of the land from whom this wealth is extracted are illiterate, not knowledgeable, uninformed. This is the fundamental mistake which they make. Those who actually live there and whose land is being degraded, whose fishing ponds are being polluted, whose farmlands have been totally rendered useless for farming purposes, whose very air, you know, has been completely toxified by decades of gas flaring, they make a mistake when they think they do not observe the digits of profit, the statistics of profit being turned in by the companies, in other words, to the detriment of their own existence. And so the militancy in the oil-producing region has escalated in recent months. You must have heard of hostage taking, and I personally, I'm in a position to tell you that I've participated in the effort to release those hostages, which came to a successful conclusion. So I'm in touch with some of these people, these young people, highly motivated. They're not thugs, they're not riffraffs, as they're sometimes portrayed. They're disciplined, and they are determined to correct decades of injustice, and that's all they're really after. You may disagree with their methods, but believe me, nobody should underestimate the very deep motivation that impels these people.
Talk about a negotiation that you were involved with and how you get involved and who was taken.
Foreign workers, foreign oil workers. There was first the first batch of four, and I made an appeal publicly that, you know, hostage taking is not in our tradition, and that we can, the other methods for fighting their battle, and they responded.
The company that they, in that case.
No, I'm talking about the.
I know,
the
but the company that they took the workers from.
Shell was involved. Shell was definitely involved, and one or two others I can't remember now. And they've been warning the stations to close down their operations and so on. And so they released those four. And so when the government, instead of responding in a responsible way, committed certain, you know, took certain violent actions in that area under the pretext that they were trying to bomb out the barges of oil bunkers. But of course, they killed innocent civilians. So the militants got increasingly, you know, frustrated, distrustful, and they went ahead, blew up a few more float stations, disrupted some pipelines, and abducted nine foreign oil workers. Eventually, they released six, and so it was over the remaining three that an appeal came to me. In fact, from both the United States and some of the peace brokers in Nigeria, you know, and asked if I could intervene, see if I could get in touch with these militants and speak to them and try and set out some means of resolving once and for all the whole situation. So I was able to get in touch with them. And in addition to the efforts of the elders and the sort of softening of the position of the federal government and the action of the United States, which sent a negotiating team there, a very serious negotiating team, I must say, which understood very well that, as I told them, they better not try any Rambo tactics in the Delta region. And they said, in fact, they were more concerned about Rambo tactics on behalf of the federal government of Nigeria. So anyway, over days and so, you know, that situation was resolved. But on one condition, there was a new condition which was placed before the federal government, and that is that the agreements known as the Yenagoa agreements between the rebels and the government must now be overseen by a consortium, a commission, an international commission made up of the United States and Britain, which have oil companies in that area. And so that's the situation in which I left it in Nigeria, when I left Nigeria.
Do you think oil fuels the conflict in Sudan and Chad?
In the case of Darfur, oil is not a very big issue. There is a clear case of an exaggerated sense of racial purity or racial belonging, the assertion of race, the minority Arab peoples there, have suddenly, well, not suddenly, this has been brewing for some time. It's connected with what went on in the south, the intransigence of the Sudanese government, even the element of having face saving, having lost face, I think. We mustn't underestimate that in the southern region, the notion of a rebellion taking place in another part of the country. I think we're dealing with human beings with a lot of ego, both collective and individual ego. And this has fueled the crisis in Darfur. I think oil is playing a very little role in the Darfur.
But since oil is in Sudan and another region, it does shore up the government, just overall its power.
Yes, but the negotiations which took place between the Khartoum and the southern Sudan has sort of limited, I think, the anxieties of the Khartoum government about accessibility to oil.
Wole Soyinka is our guest. We have to end the program here, part two of our conversation with Soyinka tomorrow on Democracy Now! His book is called You Must Set Forth at Dawn. And tomorrow we'll talk about his life. This is Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Jenny Hughes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin, Megan Whitney. Our website, democracynow.org. Happy birthday to Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!